It's no coincidence this module is called Sustainability in the Global and Local Environment. Sustainability, however we define it, is a global issue, but it's also a local issue. Sustainability affects real people living in real places. There is no place called global. For a moment, think about a place you know well. Perhaps a city, town, or village where you were brought up. It could be a school, a house, a place of worship, or a place where you went with friends or family. It might be a play park or a swimming pool. What is special about that place? I don't know what place you're thinking about, but I know that that place is unique. It occupies a particular space on the surface of the earth, and there is no other place like it. Whatever feelings you have for this place, positive and negative, it is part of who you are. If that place is threatened in some way, you may feel that you are threatened personally. When a school is closed down, or a building is scheduled for demolition, or a new road is to be built, there are often protests. To the outside observer, these events might seem like rational decisions, but attacks on our buildings, our landscapes, and our places are an attack on us. I grew up in a village with an animal feeds factory right in the centre. The factory bordered the infant school, and my friends and I would often look through the chain-link fence and watch the comings and goings during playtime. The factory later closed down. A large supermarket is now on the site. It was a supermarket we didn't want, we didn't need, and we wouldn't use. It would destroy our established local shops, which has existed for as long as anyone could remember. 10 years later, it is heaving with people and is now being expanded. In the 1950s, the residents of a village in northwest Wales discovered they were facing more than the loss of a cherished building or the arrival of a supermarket. Their village, Capel Celyn, was fairly flat and surrounded by mountains. A reservoir was going to be built. The reservoir was not near Capel Celyn. The reservoir was Capel Celyn. The reservoir was needed to supply water to Liverpool. All Liverpool City Council needed was an Act of Parliament. It didn't matter what the people of Capel Celyn or their local councillors or their Member of Parliament thought. The protests galvanised support across Wales. When the bill was voted in the UK Parliament, 35 out of 36 Welsh MPs opposed the plans. The bill passed anyway. Capel Celyn was more than Capel Celyn. It was a predominantly Welsh-speaking community at a time when numbers speaking the language were decreasing. It also illustrated that the politicians of Wales as a whole were powerless against the water needs of a large English city, even if they were all united. It illustrated that the people of the village had no power to stop their homes from being submerged underwater. One choice they did have was whether they wanted to dig up their relatives in the graveyard and bury them elsewhere. Even the dead were not safe. In the early 1970s, work started on the James Bay hydroelectric project in the Canadian province of Quebec. The dam lies over 1,000 kilometres north of Montreal, the largest city in Quebec. Though the territory of Quebec is around 3 times the size of France, it is home to just 7 million people, around 90% of whom live along the St. Lawrence River, most within about 150 kilometres of the US border. It is the only part of North America where the majority of the population speak French as their first language. The northern two-thirds of the province are home to just 20,000 people, mostly Cree and Inuit, native peoples. The building of the dam needs to be placed into a socio and political context. During the 1960s, Quebec went through a rapid period of modernization and cultural change known as the Quiet Revolution, or La Révolution Tranquille. We don't have time to go into the details of the Quiet Revolution, but the changes brought about included an increased support for separatism from the rest of Canada, a more assertive French language, Quebecois identity, and a desire for economic sovereignty. Most industry in Quebec, energy included, was dominated by English, Canadian and US interests. The James Bay project was an assertion of an increasingly confident Quebecois identity. It also enabled Quebec to have control of its own energy supply. This was well illustrated during the North American blackout of August 2003, where Quebec, unlike the rest of eastern United States and Canada, was unaffected by the loss of power. The construction of the dam remains controversial. So the planners, Northern Quebec looked like a sparsely populated, essentially blank space or white space. The native people of the regions, the Cree and Inuit, were, and still are, predominantly nomadic hunters, trappers and fishermen. The native peoples depend upon hunting and trapping and fishing for food. There is no agriculture at this latitude. The impact on the environment and the impact on the lifestyle of the native peoples were not even considerations in the early 1970s. A legal challenge to the project meant that the work was unable to go ahead until a legal agreement was put into place between Hydro-Québec, which was owned by the Quebec government, and local residents. In the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement signed in 1975, the native peoples agreed to surrender parts of their traditional lands to the Quebec government in return for financial compensation paid into the three native development corporations. There is still controversy about the extent of the environmental impact, but the building of the dams did impact upon traditional hunting routes on access to St. James Bay itself. In his introduction to the James Bay and North Quebec Agreement, John Sakia, member of the National Assembly for Mont-Royal and special representative of the then-Premier Robert Bourassa, outlined two principles which he considered equal. Firstly, the first is that Quebec needs to use the resources of its territory, all its territory, for the benefit of its people. The second principle is that we must recommend the needs of the native peoples, the Crees and the Inuit, who have a different culture and a different way of life to those from other people of Canada. These are both interesting principles which can think through. The first principle is about the need for territory to use its resources for the benefit of everybody in that territory. The cases of James Bay and Kapalkelin bear an interesting parallel here. In both cases, the displacement of a small number of people might be justified on the grounds that a large number of people elsewhere would benefit. The notion of a greater good is applied here. The second principle is about the needs of native people or minorities who have different way of life to the majority of the population. The Cree and Inuit are nomadic hunters, trappers and fishermen speaking their own language, in contrast to the mainly urban Quebecers speaking French but also English in some cases. The people of Kapalkelin were predominantly Welsh-speaking rural dwellers employed in agriculture, in contrast to the English-speaking urban industrial residents of Liverpool. The people of Kapalkelin and the people of James Bay were small in number. Although both were in democratic countries, both communities failed in their attempts to maintain their way of life in face of a geographically distant, powerful majority urban culture. The 19th century social philosopher John Stuart Mill wrote of the tyranny of the majority. In democratic societies, there is no individual despot or tyrant, but society itself can become the tyrant, oppressing those who for one reason or another dissent from their society's prevailing opinions. These dissenters may be ethnic, religious, cultural, political or linguistic minorities who face oppression from the majority view of society. The water demands of Liverpool and the desire for a flagship engineering project in Quebec, as well as cheap electricity, might be seen as part of the tyranny of the majority as their interests differed from those of the minority. The oppression is administered through the state itself, in the case of Kapalkelin through the Westminster Parliament. We might argue, defending these case studies, on the grounds of a greater good which outweighs the rights of a minority. But is the greater good a price worth paying? What is a greater good anyway in situations like the ones we've discussed here? Is the greater good a euphemism for the tyranny of the majority? David Crystal, in his book Language Death, says that the death of a language is the death of a serious loss of inherited knowledge. Some of this knowledge may be about medicine, agriculture and sustainable living. Displacing minority linguistics community is one of the causes of language death, and the effects are not always understood at the time. But is the defence of a linguistic or cultural minority community more defensible than the loss of other communities? We don't even have to look too far from Southampton to find examples of former communities. The village of Imber on Salisbury Plain was taken over in 1943 to be used for military training. The residents were given 47 days' notice to leave, and they have never been back. Or what about the village of Barton-on-Sea, where coastal erosion has claimed several buildings in the past few decades? In the 1940s, reservoirs were built in the Derwent Valley in Derbyshire. Not all the buildings in the Derwent village were knocked down. A particularly haunting image is of a photograph of the church of spire rising from the reservoir. The spire was demolished in 1947, but the picture remains an iconic image. It is interesting to compare the responses to the Derwent Valley with those of Capelkelln. Protests occurred in both cases, but Capelkelln symbolised something much bigger. While protests accompanied the official opening of Capelkelln, the Ladybower Reservoir in the Derwent Valley was opened in 1945 by King George VI amid much pomp and ceremony. These discussions are also carried through literature and poetry. The Welsh poet R.S. Thomas reflected on this in his poem, The Reservoirs. There are places in Wales I don't go, reservoirs that are the subconscious of a people troubled far down, with gravestones, chapels, villages even. The serenity of their expression revolts me. It is a pose for strangers, a watercolour's appeal to the mass instead of the poem's harsher conditions. There are the hills too, gardens gone under the scum of the forests and the smashed faces of the farms with the stone trickle of their tears down the hillside. Where can I go then from the smell of decay, from putrefying of a dead nation? I've walked the shore for an hour and seen the English scavenging among the remains of our culture, covering the sand like the tide and with the roughness of the tide, elbowing our language into the grave we have dug for it. Another idea we can work with is that of the other or otherness. The idea of otherness was popularised by Edward Said in his seminal work Orientalism. Said understood how Orientalism as how Europeans or the West understood the Orient or the Middle East. The Orient, a place of romance, exotic beings, haunted memories and landscapes, remarkable experiences. The emotions are complex, yet the idea of the Orientalism could be thought of as useful in describing the relationships in the UK government and the residents of Capelkelln and the Quebec and Canadian governments of the people of James Bay. Capelkelln lies just outside the Snowdonia National Park and within what geographer Dennis Cosgrove called wild and upland Britain, a part of Britain geographically and culturally distant from the City of London and the home counties. The remote romanticisation of the lives of native peoples of North America, living in harmony with their natural environment, is nothing new. This can be well illustrated by the Ojibwa conservationist Grey Owl, who turned out not to be a First Nations person, but a man called Arshinal Benaney, a native of East Sussex. This otherness is complex, romantic, uncivilised, barbaric, exotic, in harmony with nature, cruel, traditional, backward. In both Canada and the USA, native identity is problematic. How much native blood does a person need to live on the reservation and be identified as an indigenous person? The Mohawks of Kanawake, an Indian reservation south of Montreal, has complex rules about who can become a member of the community. Among other qualifications, a member needs to have at least one Kirinakwa, at least four Kunakaka great-grandparents. Membership also excludes children of non-Indigenous descent who are adopted by Kinawake and non-Indigenous spouses or partners. These rules are not without controversy, and there have been accusations that revisions of the rules in 2007 amount to ethnic cleansing. The connections between protecting a traditional culture and exclusion from a territory on the grounds of race or an insufficient amount of the right ancestry are highly problematic. During the lead-up to the submersion of Capelkelln, a journalist from the Times reported his meeting with a Mr. Jones who lived in the village, a life very distant and other to the average Times reader. Behind the chapel lives Mr. G.P. Jones, the country patrol shepherd, who walks 20 miles every day over the mountains on the lookout for sheep that are sick, stolen, or strayed. Differently shaped, cut in their ears, help him to tell him to whom they belong. He knows hundreds of these patterns. If he is really stumped, he can tell the difference between sheep belonging to farms 15 miles apart just by looking at the wool, because, he says, the climate is different. His simple life provides a strange contrast with the scientific engineering only a short distance away. The waters of the dam will help light people's homes as well as slake their thirst. It is an odd thought that when Mr. Jones wants electricity, he has to switch on his own generator. There's always sometimes a desire to preserve what is seen as a minority culture, almost museum-like. It brings us to what historian Eric Hobsbawm calls invention of tradition. There's an apocryphal story of the schoolboy who wrote, "Abraham Lincoln was born in a log cabin he built with his own hands." But the invention of tradition is no less factitious. These attempts to invent tradition affect who is seen as belonging and who is not. Urban migrants, non-locals, non-whites, gypsies and travellers are missing in their idyllic representations of the countryside. The idea of an unchanging countryside is an appealing though erroneous notion. There is something somehow romantic and otherworldly about the work of Mr. Jones, who I quoted earlier. The countryside's always been in a state of change, though. The enclosure of agricultural land from the late medieval period prevented poor people from freely grazing their animals on common land. Rural landscapes, like urban landscapes, are always in a state of change. For example, National Trust has recently acquired Croom Park in Worcestershire, a project of the landscape gardener Lancelot, or Capability Brown, who lived from 1716 to 1783. At Croom Park, Brown even went as far as demolishing a medieval church and building an artificial lake, reputedly shaped as a model of the River Severn. Brown's work is also celebrated at big houses such as Blenheim Palace and Warwick Castle. In the late 19th and early 20th century, Cecil Sharp, a graduate of Cambridge University, began collecting folk songs from all over the British Isles. He also visited North America. Rural, unsophisticated, less educated people in remote areas were seen as the sources of these songs. Again, the countryside was a place where old traditions, lost through the processes of industrialisation and urbanisation, could still be found. Sharp's contemporaries included Edward Elgar and Ralph Vaughan Williams, composers of nationalistic music in the pastoral tradition. In the 1980s, the historian Robert Hewison wrote The Heritage Industry, a book which lamented that the only industry Britain has left is its past. It has become centred on preserving the past, moreover, a specifically ideal and basically untrue view of the past. The idea of the threatened community, the threatened culture, is taken to another level by Douglas Adams in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The first book opens with the protagonist, Arthur Dent, trying to stop bulldozers from demolishing his house to make way for a bypass. Dent's house is, as it were, his culture. It is where he feels safe and at his most contented. Now this safe space is threatened from outside. Dent's home is about to be demolished. Unknown to Dent, the Vogons, a particularly unpleasant extraterrestrial species, are about to demolish the Earth and make way for a hyperspace bypass. Now it is the Earth which is in the way. The Earth is halting progress for the rest of the universe. You may be able to spot where I am now taking this analysis. Think of James Bay, Capelkelln, Imber, etc., etc., as metaphors for how the Vogons see the Earth. The Earth is not important, it is in the way, it can make for something better. Its inhabitants are primitive. When they protest, the Vogon captain informs the people of Earth that their plans have been on display on Alpha Centauri for the past 50 years. It is humankind's own fault they don't take an interest in local affairs. Earth is a blank space in the universe. Earth culture is looked down upon. It is primitive, backward, insignificant. Earth is so insignificant that its entry in the Hitchhiker's Guide simply reads harmless. Raymond Williams described culture as one of the two or three most complicated words in the English language. The term has a complex linguistic evolution from its early use in connection with cultivating a land. We make judgments about high culture, Mozart, Bach, the Proms, opera, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, or low culture, Big Brother, Nuts magazine, TV soaps, or folk culture, Morris dancing, male voice choirs, brass bands, many of these associated with regional and local identities in Britain. Sustaining culture for future generations is not a value-free process, no means by which we might sustain or not sustain our cultural heritage. Culture is not fixed, it is constantly invented and reinvented, interpreted and reinterpreted. Efforts are made to keep some languages going, but not others. Rules are rewritten to signify who belongs and who does not belong to a particular group. The boundaries between cultural sustainability and racism can become unclear. Some buildings are knocked down while others are saved. Some authors are remembered centuries after their death. Others, famous in their own time, are largely forgotten by future generations. Culture is an important aspect of sustainability. It is also a highly complex aspect which goes to the heart of key ideas of identity, morality, ethics, love and heritage. Sustainability is not just about enabling humans to stay alive, but thinking about what they want to live for. Limits to Growth is well known, from 1972 is well known, but their rewrite 20 years later called Beyond the Limits, went beyond the computer models of the 1970s. The authors wrote, "We think that the human race is up to the challenge. We think a better world is possible, and the acceptance of physical limits is the first step toward getting there. We see easing down from unsustainability not as sacrifice, but as an opportunity to stop battering against the Earth's limit and start transcending self-imposed and unnecessary limits in human institutions, mindsets, beliefs and ethics." That's why we decide to call it an update, and not just to update and reissue the limits to growth, but rewrite it completely and call it Beyond the Limits. Then they go on. "One is not allowed in the modern culture to speak about love, except in the most romantic and trivial sense of the world. Anyone who calls upon the capacity of people to practice brotherly and sister love is more likely to be ridiculed than taken seriously. The deepest difference between optimists and pessimists is their position in the debate about whether human beings are able to operate collectively from a basis of love in a society that systematically develops in people their individualism, their competitiveness and their cynicism. The pessimists are in the majority." Wonder whether we'd have questions to ponder. I've got a few ideas here. The Brundtland Report defines sustainable development as development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. How might you apply this idea to culture? What has love and other human emotions got to do with living sustainably? What is lost or gained if a language or culture dies? Think about how you might see the following through the lens of sustainability: a novel you've read, a photograph or painting, a piece of music. Think of how we might use these. Just